Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 16th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning, our presenter is Dave Crow. Today's session is CRD 2001-01, and it's titled Life in a Welfare State. Let's listen in.
Start then. And I'm supposed to let that thing know that this is the official start of class. Now they're recording everything you say, so watch it. My name is Dave Crow, and I teach English at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. I live across the Mississippi in Davenport. I attend St. Paul Lutheran Church in Davenport. My wife is next door teaching a journaling class. Actually, she's a nicer person than I am, so you may want to run over there. She's a part-time English teacher in the department as well. I teach 20th century American literature. That's where my expertise is, and I'd be happy to talk out of that expertise today. My only expertise for talking about Norway is that I lived there for a year, about a year ago. So that's and had my eyes open, I hope. And so that's the authority I'll be speaking out of today and for the next few days, if you care to stay with this this topic. I also have kids, which you see running around here. Michael's 10, Tyler is 9, and Emily is 6. And they were, of course, all in Norway with me. And so I'll be talking a little bit about their experience. Can you all hear me fine? Is this okay? Okay,
yep.
Good. I suppose there are two different kinds of teachers, or maybe there are two different ways of teaching. Sometimes you speak out of your knowledge and you inform people, and sometimes you, as a teacher, you simply walk into the room and open up questions. There will be a little of each today, but really the emphasis is on opening up questions. So you will be speaking, of course, and you can do it sporadically throughout the presentation as you have input or you have questions that you want to ask. Or we can work it where I talk for a while and maybe we reserve time at the end of the session for an open discussion. It doesn't really matter to me. So by all means, feel invited at any time to ask your questions or to interject. I'm not really happy with the title that got advertised for today, although it's my own fault. I sent it in a few months ago. But the overarching title of the presentations I'll be making throughout the week is this, Called to the Welfare of Others, Norway. And that's my central focus. I know this topic doesn't seem like it has very obvious spiritual content, and so maybe I can talk about that for just a minute in order to make the connection. The two words I'd like to talk about, I suppose, are called and welfare. I understand there's some really good sessions going on this week, and there were last week, on the concept of calling and vocation. Let me tell you a little bit about how I understand that word, and then we'll move into Norway. There's a guy named Frederick Buechner who I think says it most elegantly. He says that our calling in the world is where our great joy meets the world's great need. And I think that's really elegant, where our great joy meets the world's great need. In other words, where what we do well and what we love to do fulfills a need in the world. Sometimes it seems to me we take the concept of calling merely personally. It's about what we as individuals can do, what we think about our talents, and about where we can meet needs in the world. But surely there are also, and the Norwegians I think have figured this out, surely there are also ways in which we institutionalize our calling of responsibility for other people. And that's, I think, what we're going to focus on. I mean, we've got an entire national economy set up to meet citizens' needs in Norway in an entirely different way than we do it in the U.S. Now, I don't have a strong agenda. I'm not here to promote the Norwegian way over against the U.S. way. I just want to open up this larger question. The other word to talk about here, I suppose, is welfare. And by welfare, I don't mean she's on welfare. I mean the force of the word in this sentence. I care about the welfare of my children. I care about the welfare of my neighbors. We had perfect scripture yesterday, both in the morning and evening services, for talking about this, the story of the Good Samaritan, where a suffering man's needs are met immediately on the road. Not immediately, people pass him by, but his immediate needs are met by a caring person on the road. But the beautiful part about that story, I think, is the end of it, where the Samaritan takes the suffering person to the inn and hands over a couple of coins and says, "This should meet his immediate expenses. I have to go now. You take care of him, and whatever further expenses there are, I will cover." Right? That's an ongoing commitment to the welfare of that person. I think there's a biblical basis, in other words, for some of the stuff we're talking about today. All of this sounds very earnest so far, but a lot of it, I'm going to try and address this in as concrete a way as I can. I'm going to tell you stories about what it's like to live in a welfare state in a variety of areas, and you can share your stories back with me about that. It's an amazing, amazing experience, or at least it was for me. Here's my hand-drawn map of Norway.
Pretty good.
What do you think?
Yeah.
It's actually not long enough. No, it's not bad. Do you, you can't do this with continents, I don't believe, but if you stuck a pin in the bottom of Norway and swiveled it down, this point would be south of Rome.
What?
It's a long, long country. But in many, a beautiful country, but in many ways a desolate country. Only 3% of the land in Norway is arable. So a lot of the food for Norway comes in from the outside. And it really, this helps define the national character, I think. Hardworking, in a sense, suffering people for many, many years. Protecting their own, especially their farmers. This is sort of the way they work. All of this has changed, of course, in the last 25 years. Do you know why?
Oil.
That's right. Oil and natural gas coming out of the North Sea. Right now, the Norwegians are sitting on billions and billions of dollars or kroner in funds, reserves that come from their oil industry. They can't even release this money into their economy as quickly as they might like to. They do without because they're deathly afraid that they'll cause runaway inflation if too much of that money enters into their economy. So here they sit on this enormous pile of cash. And that's, we're coming back to that. One of the questions I'm interested in is whether a welfare state of the Norwegian kind is sustainable without this kind of free money resting underneath it. I don't know. Well, anyway, so in August of 1999, after I had painted a couple of Victorian houses to make money to afford to do this, I had a Fulbright grant, which paid for my expenses, but not my family's expenses, so I had to make a bunch of money. And I was a house painter the summer before we went to Norway. Well, after doing that, we piled up, and each of us had two suitcases to live out of for the year, each of the five of us. 10 suitcases went through O'Hare Airport. Unbelievable. And we found ourselves then in August in Bergen, Norway, here on the North Sea. You see how close you are to the Arctic Circle, just a few hundred miles. But in fact, Bergen is very, very temperate and warm. The temperatures were in the 40s and 50s almost all year long. It rains about 250 days a year in Bergen. It rained constantly. It rained. It was like inside your house, it was like being inside an automatic car wash. And so we had our Teflon-coated nylon pants and jackets, and we'd stand at the bus stops for 40 minutes with the rain pouring down. And we were fine. No car. We were fine. Oslo, of course, is much crisper and colder because it's inland. Trondheim, where my wife's family comes from, and Tromsø, I put up here. These are sort of the four major cities, or four of the major cities. I put them up because they're also the university cities. And I got to guest lecture at this one up in Tromsø. It's the world's most northern university, and it has the world's most northern brewery. I availed myself of both. I gave a lecture on a day in November, and there was a kind of dawn dusk from 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, and that was it. It was dark otherwise, just completely dark. So, fascinating place to live. What I'd like to do for the rest of the time then is to give you a kind of mini tour through four places in Bergen, or actually the suburb I lived in. Bønes, okay? It was just a short bus ride outside of Bergen, or along Bergen. It's right on the lake that Grieg's house is on, if you've ever been to Bergen. It's kind of a fjord lake. Well, we'll go to the local store, and I'm going to fudge on this one. We're not going to just one local store. We're going to go to the grocery store up the street and to the clothing store downtown. We're going to go to the neighborhood school where my sons attended grade school. My daughter was too young. She could have gone to Barnehage, which means kindergarten or child's garden, but it was just too expensive for us on our income, and she wanted to be with her mom. My daughter did. But we'll go to the school and talk about that. We'll visit the hospital real briefly and talk about some of the things going on there. And finally, we'll end up in the church. Again, interject whenever you've got stuff that you want to talk about. We found ourselves then in August of 99 in Bergen, and we'd arranged our housing. We had to find our own housing, and we arranged it by contacting the university, and it turned out that a woman in my department, the American Studies or English department at the University of Bergen, I guess I haven't mentioned, that was my job for the year. I taught American Studies course in the University of Bergen and also conducted some research of my own. Well, a woman in the department was going to be in Chapel Hill for the year, and she wanted someone to occupy her house and babysit her antique Steinway piano. And she felt that we seemed like responsible people, and so we worked out a rental agreement with her. And so we had a nice family home in suburban Bergen for the year. And we did yell at our children all year long, stay away from that piano. That's the price we paid for the nice place we had to live in. So it was a great opportunity for us to see how a family very much parallel to ours would live in Norway. Teachers in the middle class, university teachers with children. Their children were a bit older, but we met neighbors who were exactly like us. He's a university teacher, she's another teacher, three children almost exactly the same ages, just down the hill from us, and they are moving to Ann Arbor for the year next month. Mm-hmm. And is that going to be interesting? We'll compare their experience to our experience in Norway. They're dear, dear friends now, so we were very lucky. The first thing that occurred to us in the first few days was that the commercial life of Norway is entirely different from the U.S. There are not restaurants, cafes, drugstores in the housing areas. There's a downtown Bergen that has all of these things sort of concentrated, almost like an American downtown in the 1950s, if you know what I mean. But there's simply, well, except that there were not those corner stores and neighborhood stores that you would expect. There was in one grocery store nearby, about a block away, which was fine for us, lucky for us, since we didn't have transportation, didn't have a car, and a haircutter, and a couple of other establishments. But for the most part, Norwegians seem to be dedicated to keeping their downtown areas intact. And so they simply limit the amount of commercial property in living neighborhoods. The other thing that immediately came home to us was that our house was probably a bit smaller and a bit more modest than we would be used to in our same income bracket in the U.S. Of course, that's going to vary from family to family. But I think it's safe to say that Norwegians are living with less for their own reasons than most of us or many of us do in the U.S. Again, we'll come back to that. So let's go to this local store. It's right up the mountain. We lived on a mountain. You're either walking like this or straight up or straight down all the time. It's a rocky mountain, this stuff everywhere. For the kids to have soccer fields to play on, they have to dynamite out flat areas and cover them with cinders. There's no grass on the fields, just cinders, because you're on a stone mountain. And
granite, more granite.
Exactly, that's right. A geologist at my school, at Augustana, I hope this isn't a reflection on our quality of our liberal arts education. The geologist writes to me and he says, is there any exposed rock in Norway? That's all it is exposed rock. Well, so we walk up the street to the local store, and this is actually what we did on our second day in Norway, and talk about shock. Talk about culture shock. We were told, this is one of the larger supermarkets in the Bergen area, so a more complete selection than you would normally get in Norway. And it turned out to be about as large as this room, about like an ambitious 7-Eleven in the U.S., right? And it was packed full of goods. I mean, there was a reasonable variety. We actually lived very, very well out of that grocery store. But a limited variety, of course, the Norwegian emphasis, the brown cheese, the brunost, that caramely sweet brown stuff that they all love to eat. And, anyway, you guys like Yatos? Oh man, I think it tastes like the feet of the sheep it comes from. But you could get a brunost in cow, which I liked very much. That was fine. Or grew to like it. But of course, a large selection of other cheeses. Norvegia is the classic cheese in Norway. It's kind of like a mozzarella, a light cheese. And that's what everybody eats all the time. Great bread. Cheap fish, cod coming in every day fresh from the seacoast, and you could get it pretty cheap. Coffee and cod were the only two things that were cheap in that store. I'll give you an indication of some of the other things. I guess it's just a family habit. We eat a lot of chicken. Chicken breasts about this big, about half the size that you'd expect in the U.S., over $3 a piece in the grocery store. And everything else basically consequent with that, beef, anything other than fish, coffee, and perhaps cheese, was just incredibly expensive. And we grew to learn that this is part of the fabric of the welfare state. Everything, including food, is taxed at a very, very high rate. Since I'm talking about the sort of economy here generally, I can talk a little bit about wage earning in Norway. I did a bunch of guest lectures. I was paid by the Fulbright Association while I was in the country, but I also did a bunch of guest lecturing at different universities and then was paid cash or paid regular income from those places. And so I learned a little bit about the tax schedule in Norway. Now, I've read recently that in the 1970s, taxes in Norway, it could approach 70% of your pay. It's not the case any longer. Most families are not paying much above 30, 32 in terms of income tax. That's where it tops out, which seems curious, I think, to many of us who've heard about high tax Scandinavia. I was forced to be taxed at 50% because I was a visitor in the country and they didn't know how much money I was going to make. And it was all part of the situation. So I was taxed at 50%, which did feel like quite a hit on your paycheck, you know. But actually, I got much of it back as a tax return. And now, just last month, these Norwegian things keep showing up in our box. And my Norwegian isn't terribly good, but I sort of began to gather what it is. It's my vacation money. The money from the Norwegian state for my vacation has been showing up.
That was withheld.
Not specifically withheld. It's actually a grant from the government to foster your vacation. Yeah, I got my withholding back earlier, actually, because I was not continuing in the state. Incredible. Yeah, I mean, of course, in a sense, it comes from the tax revenue, so in a sense, it's your money. Yeah,
sure.
Well, yeah. So I mean, you know, I mean, a pretty good percentage, actually, a few hundred bucks have come into my pocket because of this feriepenger vacation money. But what you quickly find is that everything else in the country, apart from income, is heavily, heavily taxed. We discovered early in the fall that if we were going to be comfortable under our rain gear, we were going to have fleeces. And in fact, this one came to Norway during that year. Each of us got a fleece jacket for under our raincoat. We looked around town trying to buy Norwegian goods, and a jacket like that was going to be at least $135. In Bergen, unless it was lower quality and maybe you could get it for around $100. And we thought, that's just a lot. And we looked, of course, at L.L. Bean and Land's End. You can get online and order. And that jacket, I think, is $35 or $39 in L.L. Bean. So we thought, okay, good deal. This is what we need to do. We ordered our jackets and a few other goods. I think the order amounted to something like $300. It comes a couple of weeks later, and the post office says, you may pick up your box after you pay your duty. yeah. And so we went and found out how much duty there would be on this, and we thought, my gosh, it's still one-third the cost of Norwegian goods. We should be fine. It doubled the cost of the order, very nearly doubled the cost of the order on the duty on these goods. And that's how the welfare state is being underwritten. The revenue has to come in from somewhere, and this is how it's going. There's a double purpose here. You're putting revenue together for the welfare state, and you're protecting Norwegian businesses. And Norwegian businesses are protected. There is high incentive to keep buying in Norway and not buy internationally. And Norway is almost a kind of artificial economy. It's not participating with the rest of the world in a kind of free and open way. And that's a choice that they've made, and I want to remain neutral about that. That's their choice. It's the way they underwrite their own national life. So what have I talked about here? I've talked about expenses, I've talked about taxation, I've talked about the size of the store, much limited. I've talked about how the clothing store downtown is much more expensive. These are the kinds of things that come home to you in Scandinavia immediately. Any questions about that or follow-up before I move on to the next place in our tour?
Question. Yeah. If you say they have this tremendous dollar reserve because of the oil,
right?
Why do they rely so heavily upon the tax? Taking on quote goods sold, is that to protect the local merchants?
That's a lot of it. It's protections and tariffs, right, to make sure that the local merchants are fine. But the other part of it, and I'm not an economist, I'm not very good at this, but the other part is that somehow using that oil reserve would be an economic problem for the country because of inflation. Maybe someone else can explain that better than I can. I don't know. Go ahead.
What are the wages?
Oh, good question. Actually, I think...
What's the question?
What are the wages in Norway? How do they compare? It's hard to talk about. I mean, it's hard to make a generalization about this, but our teacher friends seem to have an income that seemed about like ours, a modest middle-class income, you know. So, but our friend's sister was a physician in Norway, and we began to pal around with them a little bit, too. And she was making about the same money as teachers, okay? And think what an American physician is going to make normally. So there's a huge difference there. We'll get to that when we get to the hospital. All right. And other questions?
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Are they, like the Europeans, very conscientious about taking long vacations?
Oh, absolutely. I could read actually a quotation from this history of Norway. It actually ends with a generalization about the Norwegians, and I think it's a true one. Their lives are oriented around leisure. People are not working as hard as we are. They're not as frantic as we are generally. And their lives are built around that leisure time. Mm-hmm. Long vacations at holidays, and of course, the month in the summer. You get actually a month plus one day, which Gro Brundtland introduced into the country in the 1980s, so they call it Gro Day, because it's a commitment on her part to get them to a fifth week of vacation, of paid vacation. Mm-hmm. That one extra day is symbolic of the commitment to get to that fifth week. Yes.
Do you spend much money on the military?
No, they don't.
Not have a navy or anything.
Not much of a navy. They do actually. They have a navy. We got to tour a couple of their fiberglass torpedo boats and stuff. But no, their military is mostly unlike our volunteer military. Theirs is built on a year of committed service by their young men. And they're trained a bit and are stationed. They do exercises with the rest of NATO. Norway was one of the original NATO nations, yeah. But clearly, they're depending on the U.S. and other large national powers for their national security. Yep.
Are they going to adapt to Europe?
They're fighting it like mad. The rest of the Scandinavian countries are pretty well willing to get into the European community and are thinking about adopting the euro, but the Norwegians almost certainly never will because they like their lifestyle. They've got this oil money behind them. They don't need to. And they know that their lifestyle and their choices will be compromised if they go to the euro. You probably know that if you go into the EC, the European community, as I understand it, there's a certain rate of inflation or unemployment. You have to match certain levels in order to be a good member, a good standing member. And the Norwegians simply wouldn't do that because it would make them change the way they orient their country. Yeah.
Denmark is also holding out.
They're holding out too, yeah. Yeah.
I've seen on television they built this enormous floating platform to drill oil.
Yeah.
Did they build it themselves?
Yes, they do.
So they have some industry.
Yeah, their shipping industry was failing in the 1970s, and actually it's become oil rig building. If you want to come up after, I'll show you a picture of the world's largest.
I've seen on the other platform. When they float this, they drill this thing and pull it with eight steamers, you know, out in the ocean.
They put small cities on top of floating barges and put them out in the North Sea for oil. You know, dormitories actually get lifted by cranes and placed onto the decks of these things. It's incredible. Okay. The neighborhood school. My sons, who didn't speak a lick of Norwegian before they got there, we dumped them right into Norwegian school. Because on the advice of everyone, they said, do it, don't even think about it. There was an international school in English in the downtown area. First of all, we couldn't afford it. Second of all, it would be inconvenient to get the kids there every day. And thirdly, people said, get your kids into the local school and they will have the capacity to pick up the language quickly and they will adapt. And all of this turned out surprisingly to be absolutely true. It was maybe the best part of our experience being associated with this school because we met neighbors. We became part of the community. We got to meet people through the school. And our kids picked up Norwegian. They were able to negotiate Pokemon deals in Norwegian. Kunya ha denne, ja? Denne Pokemon? And that was fantastic. And one of the first things that, were a couple of experiences early in our time in Norway that were really quite defining. First of all, we show up at the school, and we were a little bit bashful about this, knowing that we weren't going to really be citizens of Norway and that it would cost the school a fair amount of money to educate our children. We felt a little bit odd about that. But we showed up and said, well, I mean, how do you feel about this to the administrator of the school? And he could not have been more welcoming. He said, your child lives in Norway for this year? He's a Norwegian. You bring your children into this school. And it went beyond that. He said, furthermore, everyone in this country who does not speak Norwegian as a first language will receive free tutoring. Your children will receive tutoring. And they did. And there was almost a kind of zealous interest in treating our children like everyone else. And that's one of the things that you experience in Norway, the sort of radical equality among people. The commitment to making everyone feel the same. It went this far. On the first day of school, we sent our kids with paper, pens, the usual stuff. All of that stuff came home. They said, no, you don't provide these things. We want every child to have exactly the same thing, so we provide them with their pens, their pencils, their paper, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Amazing. It's just an ethic of fairness that you find kind of amazing. I would be willing to warrant that the difference between the best and worst schools in Norway is nowhere near the distance between the best and worst schools in the U.S. What else can I say? Oh, I've got to tell you about the school day for the kids. It was just so strange to us. So much of Norwegian schooling is orientation to being Norwegian, so that anything that's a sort of national craft is highlighted in the school day. So my 8-year-old son got a big old knife, sharp knife, and carved wood during the daytime because Norwegians have a tradition of wood carving, so he carved wood. My 10-year-old son, because there's a tradition, how many of you have a Norwegian sweater, a Dala sweater by any chance? Just a few of you do? Well, since Norwegian wool knitting and wool craftsmanship is important, my 10-year-old son had to knit. And he's sitting on the couch knitting while he's saying, I hate this, Dad. This is terrible. We were laughing. We just loved it. Because recreation and outdoor activities are important to Norwegians, the kids would go out in the worst weather. They'd hike around. They'd build fires. They'd bake bread over fires. They'd cook pancakes on rocks. Incredible how much outdoor and leisure activity was part of their normal school day. The school day almost never lasted more than 4 hours on a given day. Sometimes it would begin at 8:30 in the morning, sometimes at 11:30. It was very, very strange. This is partly because the school is overcrowded. The academic life was much easier than in the U.S. I mean, my, I forget which son it was, but I mean, in the U.S., I mean, he's having to work through lists of 50 spelling words every few weeks, you know, learning these words. They worked on just 3 words over the same period of time in Norway, simple words, how to spell them, that sort of thing. They're just not interested in getting their kids into the academic life rigorously early. Now, by the time they're high school students, they're performing near as well as our high school kids and outperforming them in many ways too. So it's not stupid. They know what they're doing. But that's what the life in the school is like. The other thing I'd like to point out here is that, because I think this is one of the ways in which the Lutheran Church in Norway, the state church, still expresses itself in the culture. Tomorrow I'll be talking explicitly about the church, and you may know, for instance, that only about 3% of Norwegians ever darken the door of a church. Did you know that? 3%? Mm-hmm. They're thoroughly, thoroughly secularized as a culture. Nevertheless, in the school year, even though we were told the schools don't teach religion, you don't get religion in schools, they're just like an American school, we were told over and over again, it's not true. There are posters up with Jesus, and it says what, you know, things that Jesus would do, or they lit Advent candles at Christmas time. They prayed before meals. Now, it was a fairly ecumenical prayer, but they did pray in the schools. But there was also just this general sense of caringness about the school that I found absolutely fascinating. The teachers went by their first names. Tyler's teacher was, Trond. Yeah, Trond. And when Trond saw Tyler come through the door every day, he gave him a hug and talked to him. There was just a kind of intimacy about the teacher-student relationship that we don't necessarily require or see too much of in the States. It was really interesting. Furthermore, you keep your same teacher throughout grade school. Your teacher moves with you year by year. So that gets a real strong feeling of unity in the classroom. Really interesting difference.
Excuse me.
Yes.
How many students would they have in a class? How large would the class?
Not very large. The kids had, I think, 18 in each of their classes. Hey, we're doing that in Davenport. They have 18 in our class to the Davenport, too. Move to Iowa. It's a good place. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
Twice you've referred to schools that were too expensive for you to send your children, either school or preschool.
Right.
And I wondered who was sending their children there. And then you mentioned that the school was too was quite crowded. Does that mean mm-hmm. that there's a need to enlarge their physical facilities?
We found that everywhere you went in Norway, I mean, because there's a national ethic of sort of modesty, of keeping things, of not getting things too grand, everything struck us as underbuilt, except the churches, which were empty. But the school, even though it was only 3 years old and a marvelous facility, it was overcrowded. Your earlier question, the expensive private schools, there's very little private schooling going on in Norway because the public schools are so good. And that school was there pretty much just for international business people. And that's why we couldn't afford it. Yeah. Two other questions?
What in Norway, what is the mandate this country makes of education for the children? What are the ages they have?
It starts a year later than our school. It used to start 2 years later, but there was a reform a few years ago, and now it starts a year later than our schooling does. In fact, I think, and that doesn't include kindergarten, I think they begin at the age that our second graders begin, if I recall.
And then how late?
They go a year later, too. They tend to graduate from they don't really have high school per se, but they graduate from that level of schooling at around age 19. So when people come to us at university, they're a little bit more mature. And it's not unusual for them to be between 20 and, say, 27 or 8 in their university schooling.
Do most of the young men then do their year of service right after high school?
Yeah, generally between high school and any higher education they go into. Yep. And they're tracked in their high school years toward whatever they're going to do, whether it's vocational, technical, or wide open liberal arts university stuff.
Did you find that your children were blind when they came back?
Ah, that's a good question. No, I mean...
What was the question?
Were my children behind when they came back? No, not at all. It took them, I mean, they're pretty bright kids, but not fantastic, I wouldn't think. I mean, I love them. But they caught up within a week or so. Just, and I think that's just the nature of American education. I don't think we're asking that much of kids either in terms of specific knowledge. And my kids grew so much in terms of just cultural understanding and poise and ability to meet people and make friends, and that growth certainly outweighed anything academic. Mm-hmm.
The volunteer service, are they given alternatives to military service as a possibility?
Yeah, I think they are, actually. I think it's easy to be a conscientious objector in Norway. I think you can serve, for instance, in the park service or something like that as a substitute. Mm-hmm. Someone else? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is the situation with child care for working parents?
There's lots of it available, and it's all government funded. You have to pay for it, but it's government funded. The government does give you an allowance per child. In fact, Norwegians were constantly telling us, go after your allowance, go after your allowance. It was a few thousand bucks per child that we could have had annually. And we just didn't think it was ethical to go after that money since Katie was home for the year with the kids. But there's ample daycare stuff. And it is true that Norwegians, as much or more than Americans, now both partners are at work during the daytime. So the kids are mostly in daycare. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there much immigration to Norway?
Not very much at all. And, you know, I'll be talking about this later in the week, but I'll talk a bit about it now. It's very complicated, and it's sort of the dark side or the downside of the Norwegian experience. They're very ethnocentric. They tend to be very ethnocentric. There's a kind of formal welcoming of people, that is, if you're in our school, you're going to get equal treatment. But at the same time, there's a lot of talk about, you know, those Turks in Oslo, or those Africans, or those Bosnians. Yeah. For example, refugees from Eastern Europe were set up in hotels and other dwellings in Norway during the year we were there. But as the year went by, it was clear that the Norwegians were going to force these people back out.
To be on their own in Norway?
No, back out of the country. Out of the country.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. What is the completion rate for high school students?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, 99% of Norwegians are literate. And they're the biggest readers in the world, I think, apparently. Their success rate in schools is fantastic. Now, I will tell you this. Yeah, I don't have the university up there where I spend all my time in Norway. Norwegian university students are working about half as hard as American university students, I think. Really interesting.
Is there an equal representation of male and female at the university level or not?
Oh yeah, very much so. Really in all areas of life in Norway, you see very little sort of lingering sexism. Mm-hmm.
But they're not having the women in the service. They don't have to serve.
I don't know, frankly. I could find out because I've got my data book here in front of me. I don't think that women are required to serve.
Is there mining?
Can I go here first? No, we'll be right over to you. Go ahead.
I was just saying, a hospital?
We'll get to that. We need to get to that, don't we?
That is it.
Specific question about that? We'll do that next. Go ahead.
What kind of mining is there in Norway?
Mining?
Mining, yeah.
Don't recall seeing any, actually.
Is it coal or gold or iron?
I didn't see any of that. No, natural gas is the next fuel for Norway. A government actually fell while we were in Norway over the question of whether to exploit natural gas. But we better get on to this. I'm being encouraged to move on, and we really should. The hospital. I think I've said the main thing I want to say, which is that one of the striking things about the hospital, of course, is that it's free and available to everyone. There's universal coverage in Norway. In fact, again, we were encouraged to just drop our U.S. insurance, which is incredibly expensive for being abroad. But we didn't feel that was ethical either, so we kept our insurance. But they said they would have just treated us at the Norwegian hospital. No one got sick all year anyway.
Yeah.
But I do have it. And as I told you, we met this physician who works basically 7 hours a day and has her weekends off and makes about what teachers make in the U.S. So quite a difference there in terms of the professional differences for physicians. But here's a story I want to tell you that I think complicates all of this quite a bit. Even though the Haukeland Sykehus, it means sick house, basically, that's the word for hospital, even though it had all of the technology that you would expect in a modern hospital, as far as I knew, I mean, we did have to get x-rayed for TB when we came into the country. We were a little annoyed about this. But the x-ray machine had a piece of paper on it, sort of screening part of the machine, and they were using a rock to hold that piece of paper there. So it was a little more informal than we're used to seeing. But at the same time, you know, the machinery seemed to be there. But the problem in Norway right now is they don't have the people to staff the machinery. They're importing Danish and German nurses and paying them incredible amounts of money because they can't find nurses in their own country. It seems odd to me why this is. And we had a friend, Hannah, who lived down the street. She had us over for New Year's, the Millennium Shift. Just a wonderful person. I met her at the university, and she and my wife met her through the school. And she and her family invited us over a number of times. Well, she was having these headaches, mysterious headaches, and she'd get dizzy and she'd feel nauseated. And she, sought treatment for this after a while. And it went undiagnosed. They put her on some massive antibiotics for a while to see if there was some kind of infection related to it. And they explored inner ear issues. And obviously they reached the point eventually where they thought, well, we better explore the brain area just to make sure. And she was on a list to get a CAT scan for over 4 months. And I found that appalling, given that I assumed that what they might be looking for is a tumor or some other brain problem, which needs to be addressed quickly. And yet, even though the machinery was there in the hospital in a town of 300,000 people, she couldn't get the treatment she needed quickly because they couldn't find people to staff the CAT scan machine for more than 4 or 5 hours a day. I don't know, does that confirm all the fears that defeated national health care plan in the U.S.? I don't know. That's one of the questions I would open up. Yeah, you get the same stories from the Canadian system, sure.
What happens with elective surgery? Is that impossible?
No, it wasn't my impression that it was impossible. Again, there were waits for non-emergency surgery, but by and large, I'd have to say that all the friends and colleagues that I met were getting their needs met, except for this one story about Hannah that I can't quite explain. So I don't know how pervasive this kind of problem is.
But she probably felt fine about the fact she had to wait through.
She did. That's the amazing thing. She was not frustrated in any way about that wait because it's a part of the national character, again, that you're patient with these things. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do have in our country a shortage of medical personnel, you know, in many, many areas. We can't get people to staff our hospitals and, you know, emergency rooms are overcrowded and can't get nurses to do it. So it's a very big problem.
Oh, it
in general,
is.
People not wanting to go into that field.
Yeah, it is. It's a big problem.
How about crime in Norway?
There's very little. Oslo is now beginning to get more crime, but generally there's very little crime. About the hospital situation, I just want to say, and I'm here just as a kind of honest citizen myself, thinking through these problems, and the difficulty I have. I recognize that the system that the Norwegians and the Canadians have it is problematical in its own way, but I'm a little disturbed about a system in the U.S. in which people who can afford it get absolutely transcendent medical care, and I happen to be one of those people. But there are others who go completely without, and the Norwegians would not tolerate that. That's their calling that I'm talking about here. You had a...
Well, I was just going to comment that, you know, I don't have the data in front of me, but my recollection is that on global measures like infant mortality and longevity and some other things, that they're very high on the scale. And, you know, in the United States, like 30th or whatever.
Right.
They're way out there.
Exactly. If you look at the raw numbers, they're doing extremely well in terms of keeping a healthy populace. Now, again, they're a rich country with 4.5 million people. That's about the population of the state of Minnesota. So they deal with different problems than we do, clearly. Also, they limit immigration. We have 1 million every year legal and illegal immigrants coming into this country. And so maybe there's going to be a kind of base of poverty in this country that's very hard to eradicate. I don't know. You had a question, didn't you? Your hand was up?
Me?
No?
No.
Go ahead.
When we were there was a great deal of smoking.
Yeah, university students smoked like stacks. Couldn't believe it. How? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry for the time.
It's the whole European.
It is.
Is that relatively new?
Yeah, I think it's fairly recent. There's a kind of James Dean thing going on in Norway right now. The young people all wear all black all the time, and they smoke. And college students are doing it. At Augustana, yeah, we've got these sorority girls.
Probably most of the product comes from the United States.
The product probably does, yeah. Yeah. Well, she had to go outside because she had to get a smoky treat. She called it a smoky treat. I said, you mean a coffin nail? The church. So interesting, the church. Yeah, good. We got time to talk about this. We're fine. Okay, so we'd walk up our mountain to our grocery store, and we'd walk down and around our mountain to our local church. And it was a smallish worship space, not much larger than this, actually, and brand new, because a group of citizens in Bønes who didn't have their own church did a very un-Norwegian thing, and they actually volunteered to build their own church, and they did. They hired an architect out of a group of people, and they paid for much of the construction cost. Because the government didn't have the resources, or didn't feel it had the resources, to build a church in that community at that time. It's interesting, the money for building churches comes from the government, not from congregations, and it comes from the same fund that builds schools. And schools are overcrowded. Now, what's going to happen in a situation like that? You're going to build schools instead of churches. And I think this is one of the mechanisms by which a national priority is reached. The priority is clearly on schools and community centers in Norway, and not on churches. We would show up for worship, but we happen to be Lutheran, and we happen to attend church, and we happen to enjoy worship or find it an elemental part of our lives. And so we would walk every other Sunday down to our church, because they only had services every other Sunday in our community. They could only get a pastor every other Sunday. And we'd walk down there, and we had a kind of bipolar experience. Either we would be five of the 35 people in the church, or it would be packed to the rafters, and people would be in their national costumes and all of that. And those were baptism days. If there's a baptism, everyone in the family shows up for church. Even unchurched people baptize their children in Norway, because it's a kind of national tradition. It seemed to me to have very little to do with worship, ritual, liturgy. It was simply a national tradition. It was a time to express, I'm Norwegian, I put on my goofy suit, and baptize my child. Oh, I love them, they're beautiful. The Bunads, they're beautiful. On Wednesday nights, our children would go to the church for church-sponsored activities, and there'd be a very brief prayer at the beginning of the session, and then everything for the rest of the evening is completely secular. They'd go into the worship space and get out hammers and saws and build buggies right in the worship space, because there was no other space. The worship space was all they had. It was very, very interesting, the attitudes toward the church. Now, it began to grow evident to us that the church was, by and large, not a worship space. It was a community center. That's what it was for. And the only other time you'd see the church packed full was when the government, or the church through the government, excuse me, maybe I mean the government through the church, was distributing, say, Bible story books to the neighborhood children. And sure enough, if you were a child in that neighborhood, you could show up and get your free book. And the church was packed on those days. This is something I've been taught about what it means to be Christian / Lutheran. There's only two non-absurd things you can do if you're a person of faith. This is what I believe. You can serve others, right? And you can worship God. Maybe the theme that I'm going to be working with this week is that in Norway, the church is expressed through the culture in many, many complicated ways, but it's almost always expressed as service to others. And this seems to have gone out the window. You've got a nation here in which people don't seem to feel called to worship. And I find that really interesting and curious. I don't know the cause for it, I don't know how to explain it, but that's what we've got here. It seems to me maybe we've done the opposite in this country. We still have many people interested in worship and spirituality generally in a sort of ecumenical way. But I wonder sometimes how good we are at serving others in a really material, direct, and practical way. So that the contrast between the Norwegians and us seems to me just profound. Just profound. You know, they've got a protected welfare society, and we've got a big raw opportunity society. And I don't know, I guess you take your pick, don't you?
What is the position of the royal house?
The royal house?
Yeah.
It's a constitutional monarchy. They're more or less sort of figureheads, although they do technically, when there's a new prime minister, the king has to approve before the new government is ushered in. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Are the citizens still taxed and for the church?
All church funds are coming from some tax source. I don't know if it's the income tax or the sales taxes, which monies it is, but it, yes.
Goes to the state church.
Goes to the state church, yes. So that means that every single Norwegian, no matter what ethnic and religious background, every single Norwegian supports the Lutheran state church.
That's not necessarily so in all the Scandinavian countries anymore, though. Because we
returned
from there, and in Sweden they said that they've done away with that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it's really interesting the impact or effect this has. One of the things I discovered being a member of this church, I'm going to tell you a story tomorrow, actually, about why we quit this church at about Christmas time. But while we were members in good standing of the Bundeskirche, the Bundes Church, we saw such a tremendous difference from St. Paul Lutheran in Davenport. And one of the central differences was that when you pay for your own church and you pay for your own pastor, many of us, I think, are passionately invested in our churches. You don't feel that way as a Norwegian because the government puts the church there and the government pays the pastor. And even if the government can only pay the pastor to come every other Sunday, that's okay, that's the way it is. Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes.
I wonder if the correlation between worship and serving has to do with the fact that the Norwegians are comfortable economically. They don't have as much suffering and striving and hoping to win lotteries and all these miracles that God will unfold to them if they go and pray for on Sundays as we do.
Yeah.
Maybe you have to have a certain, because if you think of the Latin American cultures, with the Catholic Church in charge, they're packed.
Yeah.
Everybody's praying for miracles all the time because they're all poor.
That's an interesting observation. It really is. I don't know exactly what people would be praying for in Norway or in other places. It is interesting. No. The Norwegians actually lead the world in world missions and in per capita giving for world missions. But they don't go to church. Yes.
What other denominations are there?
There was a Seventh-day Adventist church in our neighborhood, but with very few parishioners. I've got data here on this, and I'll talk a bit about it next tomorrow. The growing denomination in Norway, the only growing denomination, is evangelical Christian. Non-denominational evangelical Christian. Yeah. There's very little Catholic presence, very little Orthodox presence, very few Jews and Muslims in the country.
Another hypothesis might be that maybe there's less emphasis on worship because they're meeting their needs for community in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, I have this feeling that there's a difference between community and the heart of worship.
Right.
Or rather, that community is only one part of the heart of worship. I don't understand why they don't want to confront the mystery of faith in their lives, frankly. But I think you're exactly right that that the feeling of community in Norway remains profound. And yeah, maybe our churches are fuller because we need that here.
Mm-hmm. Are the senior citizens taking as good care of as the children?
Absolutely. They are the leading edge of the welfare state. The welfare state grew out of a kind of social security policy to make sure that people lived well into their later years. First, it was social security of the kind maybe we would be familiar with. And then later in the 70s in Sweden and Norway, there was a commitment to making sure that people lived about as well in their retirement years as they did in their most prosperous 15 or 20 years as earners. And that's the sort of the long-term commitment. Now, interesting, it's so expensive to live in Norway that they're looking at building their retirement homes in Spain. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
The government is looking at building its retirement homes, its government-run retirement homes in Spain, where it's cheaper to build, cheaper to hire caretakers, and the sun shines.
Mm-hmm. You have a question up there, Tom?
Yep.
How is the care for special education and children, disabled people?
All of that is excellent. I don't think you could find a minority group or a special needs group in Norway whose needs aren't met. I mean, they're met.
Are they mainstreaming those kids? Are they segregated in special schools? Or?
Neither of my kids had any special needs kids in their classes, so I don't know the answer to that question. I'll look it up.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's deciding, making value judgments at a governmental level that makes your shirt cost $135, therefore you're not going to probably buy more than one.
Yeah.
Those are value judgments.
Right.
How much do the people participate in either electing or making, the decision makers are making those choices?
They participate avidly. They vote in numbers that we don't come close to.
Percentage-wise.
And furthermore, they don't allow just the school board to make decisions about their school. There's a kind of plenary meeting in the community where people show up and discuss these things and hash them out. Now, at the same time, there's almost an uncanny trust in the government in Norway. I mean, this anti-government stuff that we've seen in the U.S. for the last 25 years is completely foreign to Norwegians. They trust their government, they elect that government. Whatever it does, they're happy with. It's fine, for the most part. You're right about the value judgments. That's what we're sort of discussing here. Yep.
Is there who in a general sense is the Norwegian upper class, and what are the jobs that are the big folks?
As far as we could tell, there were people in corporate business and lawyers who seemed to be making a bit more money than the rest, but at the same time, you just really don't see that high end culture in Norway in the same way you're used to seeing here. I don't know, it's a little tricky because, I mean, we've had exchange students at Augustana whose parents are clearly making good money. They're, you know, I bought this camera in Tokyo when my dad was there and this one in Singapore, you know. So there's an international business class that's making money, but it's such a small percentage of the national population. Yes.
When I went with my daughter to Spain with her school class, and we went to southern Spain along the coast, there were towns where all the Scandinavians came for the winter. I was really surprised. Yep. So maybe that's what's tying in with your retirement.
Exactly. The Canary Islands are big among Norwegians, and Norwegian tour guides make these arranged tours to exactly the kinds of communities that, in fact, there was a TV commercial about this that was hilarious. This Norwegian family lands in a South Seas island somewhere, and they go to the hotel gift shop and they get their package of Brunost and their daily Oslo paper. And it is kind of a national joke that in general there's a kind of national timidity and a national wish to be around others like themselves that we found really interesting. You know, we were foreigners in Norway, of course, but the word was used over and over again, you're a foreigner. And there are foreigners in Norway who've been living there for 15 years. Right? One of my professors, I know we're out of time, I'll say this one last thing. One of my professors said, how long does it take for, is an American studies class, how long does it take for, say, an Austrian woman to become an American? Heavy accent, other clothing differences, how long does it take? As long as it takes for her to say, I'm an American. It takes about that long. How long does it take for an immigrant into Norway to become a Norwegian? And his answer was, we don't know yet, it hasn't happened. I hope you're interested and want to keep pursuing this. We'll have other sessions throughout the week. Thanks very much, folks.